90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world.
Good afternoon, friends and listeners. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. We've got another good show planned for you today, haven't we, Maria?
Yes, indeed. And we are so happy to be here on KPFK. I love this station. And it's not even Fun Drive. I just want to say that I love this station. I feel like it's our oasis.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Your dog loves it too. I can hear that.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, anyway, I'll just ignore him. Well,
so
I did want to tell you about this week's show. In our first half hour, constitutional scholar Stephen Rohde will take us through a speed round of this week's top court headlines, ranging, of course, from immigration, the First Amendment, transgender rights, and more. And then in our second half hour, we'll be joined by Adam Rose from Los Angeles Press Club to talk about new lawsuits against local and federal law enforcement for targeting and injuring journalists reporting on protests in LA.
Well, that's a lot to cover, so we best get right to it. We have an ambitious show, clearly. We again turn in our first segment here to our local constitutional expert to discuss some of the more important court decisions, and they do keep coming. And today, we have 9 decisions to cover. Our regular guest for this topic is, of course, Stephen Rohde. Steve Rohde now is a constitutional scholar, a writer, a lecturer, and a political activist. Steve did practice civil rights and civil liberties law for over 50 years. He's the past chair of the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, past national chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice, and he is founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and now special advisor on free speech and the First Amendment for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. I should also happily announce that he is the host of his recently launched podcast, Speaking Freely, produced by MS Studios. Of course, Steve Rohde today is speaking only for himself. Steve Rohde, thanks so much for joining us again here on the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Jim and Maria.
Well, on Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court, Steve, made a troubling decision regarding deportation. I'm speaking of the Department of Homeland Security versus DVD. What can you tell us about this case and what the decision means for the future of our country?
Well, sadly, we have an emergency president and an emergency court. What I mean by that is a president that invokes invented emergencies, but on occasion is finding a Supreme Court, half of the majority of which he appointed himself, willing to put up with his claims of emergency, and they are issuing emergency stays of lower court injunctions. This case we've been tracking before. 8 men who had been convicted of crimes, non-citizens, but they were summarily headed to South Sudan, which is a violence-plagued African country. Most of those men had never set foot in. Immigration laws have a preference for deporting individuals to their home countries. That's exactly the problem that Judge Brian Murphy in Boston saw, and on April 18, after a full detailed hearing, granted a preliminary injunction that these men could not be deported without due notice, at least 10 days plus 15 days to appeal, with an opportunity to challenge the order and to present evidence of the risk of torture or other human rights violations of where they were being sent. Well, that was too much due process for the Supreme Court majority, which on Monday, June 23rd, stayed Judge Brian Murphy's injunction, allowing the Trump administration to go full speed ahead with these dangerous deportations without due process. Now, we don't know the reasons the majority had for doing this, because they issued, they gave no reasons and they gave no explanation. They are using the shadow docket by granting a stay of the lower court injunction. They don't give reasons. And instead, they disrupt the status quo by reversing and staying that injunction. The only way we know anything about the case or the reasoning is a powerful dissent written by Justice Sotomayor with the concurrence of her colleagues, Justice Kagan and Jackson. I think it's worth the time to cite a few sentences from that dissent. She begins, "In matters of life and death, it is best to proceed with caution. In this area, the government took the opposite approach." You know, getting a stay requires clean hands. It's an equitable remedy. And instead, the government twice violated the temporary restraining order that was issued, from which they were seeking relief. It's the bound duty of the government to obey orders until reversed. And she called it the government misconduct, threatens this principle to the core. So does this court's decision to grant equitable relief. This is not the first time the court closes its eyes to non-compliance, nor I fear will be at the last. And she respectfully but regretfully dissented. I've encouraged your listeners to find these dissents by the three progressive judges. They are clear, they are articulate, and they are speaking for the rest of us.
Indeed.
Well, thanks for that, Steve. And we do have to find those silver linings where we can find them. So last Wednesday, the Supreme Court made another controversial decision. That one I'm thinking of is U.S. versus Scrimeti concerning transgender rights. Tell us a little about the Scrimeti case, what the court held, and how it may impact the fate of similar cases that are currently going through the courts throughout the country.
This is a very dangerous decision. Again, no surprise, a 6-3 decision. The Supreme Court upheld Tennessee's ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgendered teenagers. Judge John Roberts issued the opinion. There were several concurring opinions, some of which are even more terrifying than the majority opinion. And again, there's a dissent by Justice Sotomayor and her two colleagues, which said that the ruling authorizes without second thought untold harm to transgender children and the parents and families who love them. This was brought by three transgendered teens along with their parents and a Memphis doctor, alleging that the law violates their constitutional right to equal protection, should be scrutinized under the more stringent standard of heightened scrutiny than the one that the Court of Appeals below had used. Tennessee passed SB 1 back in 2023. It prohibits the use of puberty blockers and hormone therapy for transgendered teens while allowing the very same use and treatments for other purposes. The district judge, in an extensive opinion, enjoined the law. He concluded that the treatments at the center of the dispute are safe, effective, and comparable to both risk profile and efficacy to many other forms of pediatric medicine that Tennessee permits. But the Sixth Circuit reversed that ruling using the rational basis, the lowest standard for review, and now the Supreme Court has done likewise. Justice Roberts disagreed with the challenger's suggestion that a 2020 Supreme Court case, Bostock versus Clayton, It had held that federal employment discrimination laws protect LGBTQ workers, but this court would not give that kind of protection to these transgendered youth, and left that consideration for another day. Dangerously, Justice Thomas Alito and Amy Coney Barrett wanted to find that discrimination against transgendered status is not a suspect class, that this group has historically not been subject to discrimination. I mean, to say the words is how outlandish their findings, wow. And that the group is not politically powerless and therefore does not deserve that protection. This is a very terrifying decision. It's in line with overruling Roe v. Wade. The conservative justices are marching through the Republican agenda.
It sounds like some of the these conservative justices have been living under a rock if they don't understand the prejudice that transgender youth and adults face in our country. That's astonishing. Well, a case here in Los Angeles, a case that we're very much the center of, at least here in Los Angeles, I'd like to ask you about next. You know, that's the case of Steve of Newsom versus Trump. And just like it sounds, it's the governor of California suing the president of the United States. Remind us what's happened so far in this case and where it might go from here.
Yeah, this was upsetting because the trial judge had carefully considered what Donald Trump had done in invoking USC Section 12406. That does give the president the power to call into federal service members and units of the National Guard of any state, but only under specific requirements. In this case, Donald Trump did so for 60 days. The lower courts had found that he did not have the power to do so. And they analyzed that there was no emergency, that the president's use of a provision which said the president is unable with the regular forces to execute the laws of the United States. I mean, you and I and many of our listeners have been at LA protests. We've also, some of us perhaps, have been at sporting events where folks get quite wild and crazy after sporting events. None of that has required calling out the National Guard. The few incidents of violence have been blown out of all proportion by the Ninth Circuit in order to justify what Trump is doing. They even acknowledge that the protesters eventually dispersed at law enforcement's direction. But they were very deferential to the president. And this was a unanimous decision by three Ninth Circuit judges. Fortunately, they agreed that they had the authority to review the case. Trump said they shouldn't even review it, that it was a political question and beyond their review. They rejected those arguments. And they also rejected the notion of inherent powers and instead looked at this congressional act and did not reach the question whether this was a rebellion. This is a stay of an injunction. The case on the merits will go forward by the trial judge. We could hope that sober minds will come to bear. Sadly, I think this will be upheld by the Supreme Court in this interim status. And it is a victory, and we've got to acknowledge for President Trump's expansive use of his presidential powers.
Indeed, indeed.
Mm. Well, I have a question to ask you about some ICE activity. So 3 months ago, ICE agents abducted a lawful permanent resident, a Columbia University student named Mahmoud Khalil, from his home in New York without a warrant. Last Friday, he was finally released from custody. But this isn't the end of his story, is it? What's going on with Mr. Khalil's case?
This is an interim, bittersweet success. It is only right that Khalil should be home with his wife and newborn baby. Born while he was in more than 100 days of confinement, a lawful permanent resident of the United States with the proper immigration status to remain in the United States. The State Department cooked up a claim that his advocacy on behalf of the pro-Palestinian cause was dangerous to American foreign policy, and they abducted him and transported him to a prison in Louisiana. The courts there and in New Jersey have been fighting over this. Fortunately, finally, his lawyers got bail, so he was released. But instead, the government has switched their rationale from the one I just described to a claim that he lied on his application, and they've cooked up some alleged inconsistencies and mistakes in his application. I've read the details of that. At best, it might have been a misreading of the application terms, hardly lying to the government. We hope he remains free and finally wins vindication.
Well, yes. And meanwhile, Steve, one of Trump's wealthiest adversaries, Harvard, but he's tried to block the school's ability to accept international students, of course. What's happening with that case at the moment?
Well, on the side of the Harvard case, they're still fighting the entire attack on their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and the rest. But this had to do with foreign students. Fortunately, Judge Allison Burroughs in Massachusetts on June 20 issued a preliminary injunction halting Trump's prevention of Harvard's ability to enroll international students. That all came about because of Trump's May 22nd executive order revoking those statuses. She issued a thoughtful opinion justifying that. And then just on June 23rd, 2 days ago, another preliminary injunction halting Trump's June 4 proclamation banning travelers from entering the United States on Harvard's sponsored F and J visas. She wrote a 44-page, really scorching ruling. She said the proclamation quite obviously has no legitimate grounding in its stated concerns, and it is inexplicable by anything but animus. The government was relying on a general claim of national security so selective, the judge said, as to border on absurd. Trump demanded Harvard screen international applicants for their political beliefs, hire new faculty to enforce viewpoint diversity, meaning the viewpoints of Trump, and decertify a list of pro-Palestinian student groups and make various internal changes. These will be litigated, but at the preliminary stage, fortunately, the judge found that Harvard has the likelihood of succeeding. There are reports that Harvard is discussing a settlement with the Trump administration. We can only hope Harvard holds to its principles and makes no settlement that compromises those principles or capitulates to Trump's demands.
Indeed, indeed.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm co-host Maria Hall here with my co-host Jim Lafferty. We are interviewing Steve Rohde, constitutional law scholar, and giving you some of the top court news headlines this week. So, Steve, speaking of government animus and retaliation, I understand a federal judge decided to at least temporarily block the Trump administration from withholding funds to states that refuse to comply with federal immigration operations. What can you tell us about this unfolding situation?
Yet another example of abuse tying already authorized funds going to the states for a whole variety of reasons, having nothing to do with immigration or anything else. Yet Trump issued his executive order blocking billions of dollars unless these states complied with Trump's demands on immigration enforcement. On May 13, 20 states, led by Rob Bonta, the Attorney General of California, filed an elaborate lawsuit accusing the government's policy of being blatantly illegal. They called it a hostage scheme, hostaging the billions of dollars unless the states relented on Trump's immigration enforcement. This usurps Congress's authority over spending, and it was the states of California, Illinois, New Jersey, Rhode Island, Maryland, and several others. They're using a concept, and I think listeners are going to have to learn some legal language along the way, called ultra vires. Ultra vires is a Latin term. My wife, a Latin scholar, would know better than me the exact meaning, but it means beyond authority, that the president is acting beyond his authority and violating the spending clause of the Constitution, and his decision was arbitrary and capricious in violation of the Administrative Procedures Act. These are imposing unrelated conditions. And finally, on June 20, Judge John J. McDonald Jr., the chief judge of the district court in Rhode Island, issued a full preliminary injunction blocking the U.S. Department of Transportation, which is the one that imposed this, from withholding those funds. The judge said that these were unrelated conditions. Quoting the judge, "Such is not how the three equal branches of government are allowed to operate under our Constitution." Surely that will be appealed, but these wins, after developing a full record in the lower courts, are very important.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. On June 16th, Steve, the American Bar Association filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government. The suit was for the government trying to intimidate and retaliate against lawyers. What's the case based on, and what are its chances of success?
This was a very important case filed by the American Bar Association against Trump and over 24 federal departments and agencies and the heads of those agencies. A 93-page complaint. Again, these pleadings are clear and readable, and I encourage listeners to go to them. This lawsuit was filed by the law firm of Sussman Godfrey. 10 of those lawyers are on the pleading. Sussman is one of the law firms that Trump has gone after, yet they are fighting back, and they are showing that they will not be intimidated by representing the ABA in this case. The case speaks and invokes the rule of law, access to justice. The complaint said that the ABA is challenging an unprecedented and uniquely dangerous attack on the rule of law, which in its long history, the ABA has never experienced before. Trump on March 24, for example, said, "I just think that the law firms have to behave themselves." Well, fortunately, many of those lawyers are behaving themselves by standing up for the rule of law and the Constitution. The complaint lays out a request for an injunction because Trump is imposing security clearance terminations, lawyers are losing their security clearances in summary proceedings. They're losing government contracts. They're losing access to federal building and federal employees. That means they can't enter the federal courts or deal with federal clerks, and they're losing federal employment. The lawsuit has four anonymous ABA members who evidence how they've been intimidated. They've changed their pro bono policies. They've changed what clients they're choosing to represent. And the lawsuit catalogs suppression of and threatened retaliation for protected activity, viewpoint discrimination, the right to petition the government, free association, and the chilling effect this is having. So I'm very hopeful that that case will go forward. It's meant to represent the entire legal profession, not just those few law firms.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's talk quickly about separation of church and state. A federal appeals court just struck down a state law that required the Ten Commandments to be posted in public schools. Do you expect it to be appealed? And do you think someone might be trying to get this into the Supreme Court?
There's no question that's what Trump will do, but this is the Fifth Circuit with a unanimous opinion. A Biden judge, a George W. Bush judge, and a Clinton judge. A Louisiana law, and I'm shocked I'm saying the words, required a Protestant version of the Ten Commandments to be posted in every public school classroom from kindergarten through college, and to publish a statement that the Ten Commandments forms a prominent part of American public education for almost three centuries. Fortunately, the trial judge found this unconstitutional, citing a 1980 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, Stone versus Graham, where an identical Kentucky statute was struck down. Once again, the American Civil Liberties Union, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Freedom from Religious Foundation have brought this case on behalf of nine families, including clergy and their children. The first round is a great success both at the trial level and the Fifth Circuit, notoriously a conservative circuit. I would anticipate en banc review by the entire circuit, but I think this is one of the most blatant acts of a violation of the First Amendment we've seen. I think this case will be upheld, striking down the law by the Supreme Court itself.
Mm. All right, in our next segment, we're going to be going into even more detail about freedom of the press. So as a segue, as a couple of minutes we have left, Steve, please talk to us about the relief that the National Public Radio is seeking in the courts.
Yes, the National Public Radio and three Colorado affiliates sued Trump, and they technically had to sue the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is now under Trump's control, as well as the National Endowment for the Arts in the District of Columbia on May 27. A 40-page complaint pointing out that Congress made a cardinal objective that public broadcasting be shielded from, quote, extraneous interference and control to insulate broadcasters, quote, from government interference. Yet on May 1st, Trump issued an executive order he called Ending Taxpayer Sedation of biased media citing left-wing propaganda. He articulated his complaint that NPR functions as a woke network spreading diversity, inclusion, and equity. The lawsuit cites separation of powers, that ultra vires concept, the spending clause, because the authorization and spending is with Congress, not the president, the First Amendment for intimidating and seeking to coerce the messages that are expressed on NPR and the Administrative Procedures Act. The major law firm of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher was not intimidated and is representing the NPR. A motion for summary judgment seeking a permanent injunction was filed this Monday. There will be briefing and a hearing in August, and we are extremely hopeful that a preliminary injunction and final judgment will be granted in NPR's favor and strike another blow for Trump's attack on freedom of the press, independent broadcasting, and the right of the people to have access to information, even in the midst of their battle to take back democracy.
Indeed. Well, I'm afraid that that is all our time we have for this particular topic today. We'll be back with our guest, Steve Rohde, of course, down the road, as we'll continue to follow the legal scene in America. But for today, Steve, we could just thank you for another wonderful presentation and for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild Show.
I'm grateful for this forum. I'm grateful to be able to speak with your listeners and educate them as much as we can, because that's where the advocacy and the power of the people comes from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Now we'll take a brief station identification break, and then we'll be right back with you.
Carrie Harrison with your Pride Pulse. Pride isn't only about waving flags. It's about being seen. For generations, LGBTQ plus people were pushed into the shadows. Pride pulls them back into the light. Visibility is power. It creates understanding. It saves lives. And every parade, even pronoun, and post reminds someone out there you're not alone. KPFK Radio proudly joins in saying, you are seen. You are valid. Happy Pride Month.
And we are back with you. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show, my friends. And I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. And now in this segment, we talk about something very close to home, don't we, Maria?
Yes, indeed. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That is very near and dear to us on the Lawyers Guild Show and here at KPFK. Free speech, free press, the right to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress, even or especially when the powers that be don't want to hear it. And as any tyrant knows, whenever the public takes to the streets to criticize it and demand change, others see it, and then they're inspired to join. So a common tactic used to stifle protest, of course, is to control the narrative by squelching the ability of journalists to report the truth of what is happening. So today we'll be talking about how some members of the press are fighting back with lawsuits against the law enforcement officers who are targeting them at protests. Our guest this segment is Adam Rose, secretary of the Los Angeles Press Club and chair of its Press Rights Committee. In that role, Adam builds dialogue with law enforcement in Southern California, government leaders in Sacramento, and journalist organizations across the country. He successfully lobbied for Senate Bill 98, which we'll hear about in a minute, which prohibits police from arresting or intentionally interfering with journalists as they cover protests. And he's also been involved with the Los Angeles media community for two decades and was previously managing editor for news, sports, movies at Paramount Plus, served in senior newsroom leadership for the Huffington Post, worked for the LA Times, and was an editor and contributor for LAist, among many other things. Adam Rose, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Well, thank you very much for that warm welcome and for casting a light on these important issues today.
Yes, well, we're excited to learn more. So in the past week and a half, there have been several, not just one, but several lawsuits filed on behalf of Los Angeles Press Club. But before we get into what entities are being sued, can you start us off by telling us about the plaintiff? Who is LA Press Club? Who are the other plaintiffs? What's LA Press Club's mission? And who are the members?
Sure. Well, the LA Press Club is a nonprofit, 501c3, based here in lovely, sunny Southern California, where normally things are peaceful and nice and beautiful, but maybe haven't been as much recently in our own streets. So we've existed for over 100 years to help celebrate and defend journalism in all of its forms. So we look out for students, we look out for freelancers, we look out for Pulitzer Prize winners from the biggest corporate outlets. And with over 1,000 members in the Los Angeles region, we're concerned about not only the state of the industry and all the economics behind what goes on in our world. We're putting out scholarships and fellowships for up and coming journalists, doing all kinds of what I think is very important work. Unfortunately, we've had to divert a lot of our resources recently into protecting journalists who have been assaulted, detained, and even arrested by law enforcement agencies in our region. Unfortunately, this isn't exactly anything new. So our organization is one of the named plaintiffs on a number of lawsuits against various civic entities and law enforcement officials. And we're joined in different ones by different co-plaintiffs. And so maybe we'll jump ahead here and give you that breakdown because it's different for each one. Specifically with the city of Los Angeles, where we're trying to get injunctions against the use of force by LAPD, we are we're on that as a co-plaintiff with a news outlet called Status Coup. And Tina Desiree Berg is a journalist who has been in the field and repeatedly run into these issues and has had prior lawsuits with the city of LA over this. The second one is with the county of Los Angeles related to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. Again, I believe joined by Status Coup and as well as a new startup called The Southlander. Now, The Southlander probably isn't well known yet, but I think that they're very promising. They're up and coming. And these are all members of our organization, by the way, including Tina and people like Ben Camacho. That name may ring a bell to certain people here because of the infamous case where the city attorney of Los Angeles sued Ben to return public records its office had given him. So has been standing up for journalism and press access for years here, and we're very proud to be joined by him as a co-plaintiff on that case. Now, the third case is against Secretary Noem and the Department of Homeland Security. And in that one, there's a much larger slate of plaintiffs, probably won't be able to name all of them off the top of my head. This includes more than just press. Let me be very clear that through all of this, as I will tell anyone who will listen, I've never argued that press rights are superior to the rights of others. Rather, the rights of others depend on press rights. Press serve as the surrogate of the public. As I'll also say quite frequently, a democracy depends on an informed public, but that informed public depends on a free press. So in addition to press and my own organization, we're joined in that by legal observers, who I would imagine are some of your listeners, and also by protesters themselves who have had their First Amendment rights violated. So while I am not a lawyer and I can't speak to how it breaks down into causes of action and things like that, I know there's slightly different ones on that one for our organization as opposed to some of these others. So we are not, again, saying we're better than them as press in any way. We're saying our rights need to be protected so that we may serve as the surrogates of the public.
Yes. Well, tell us about the behavior of the defendants in this case, the LAPD, what have you. Tell us about the behavior of these defendants that caused you and the others to want to bring this lawsuit.
Well, there's some
serious lawsuits.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's some historical behavior that folks should be aware of that led to where we are today and the continuing pattern of conduct that led to the lawsuit itself. So the lawsuits, plural, are really about the incidents this month, of which, I've really lost count. We may have over 100 incidents in just a 1 month period or less, really, half of a month in the Southern California area. So in terms of the actual actions, what we tend to see are uses of force that cause injuries targeted at journalists or so indiscriminately applied to people that press are inevitably injured by the uses of force. These frequently take the form of what they call less lethal munitions. However, that is very euphemistic as they have caused fatal injuries. There's currently a photographer in from the Minneapolis protests in 2020 who had lost her eye and it has caused what is a brain injury that has her in hospice. So, these are in other countries, there have certainly been fatal incidents with similar munitions. Tear gas, even the numbers that I'm throwing out here, which sound galling, they don't really account probably several dozen incidences of tear gas or pepper spray. Those chemical munitions are just hard to track. You know, how do you measure that injury? Well, you know, there's trauma, vicarious trauma, there's mental health tolls, but those ones are hard to measure. Really, I'm talking about the ones where they've been impacted by a kinetic impact projectile, whether it's 37 millimeter, 40 millimeter. And then we also see detentions, kettling, which in 2021, I helped lobby for this law, which exempts press from dispersal orders and allows them to pass through these lines. So these actions of kettling, these actions of violence gassing, which I would consider violence, and even now arrest. And when I say arrest, this is one of the more disturbing incidents I've ever seen, though we still haven't seen full video. On Thursday of last week, a very young journalist who posts on social media, his name is Anthony, he was arrested while probably being the only journalist that I'm aware of who went out to an ICE raid at a Costco in Pacoima. He's the only way the world was going to really know about this.
Yes.
They arrested him for battery on a peace officer. They've not released any video. Because 48 hours doesn't count the weekend, they held him in jail for 4 days. When he was released, even the city attorney couldn't gin up an infraction charge based on whatever evidence they had. So as far as I can interpret, and again, without seeing video from Anthony, he's still recovering, obviously, from all of this, and without seeing anything released in body cam, which I've demanded from civic officials, it sounds like they punished him with 4 days in jail for the crime of taking a photograph in public.
Yes. Well, very often what the police are doing in public, they don't want the rest of the public to see. And therefore... Therefore, the press and being there posed a danger to the police from their wrongful point of view, of course. That's exactly why we do need the press there. And that's why it's always so wonderful when we're out at these demonstrations and you see the press having to sustain the rubber bullets, having to sustain often the tear gas and the pepper spray, just like the demonstrators themselves wrongfully are sustaining this on so many occasions. I'm sorry, Maria, you were going to say?
No problem at all. No, I was just going to follow up on the bill that you were talking about that you lobbied for, Adam. Senate Bill 98, and then I understand now it's a penal code section, so it's in force. Tell us about that. What are these legal protections that you were able to get codified and the specific regulations, its purpose, and how it is being implemented on the ground?
So since the days of the Wild West, California has had extra protection for press when there's a natural disaster. You know, think of a wildfire or an earthquake. And when police close an area for disaster, journalists are allowed to remain. In the 1980s, there was a case law that went to the California Court of Appeals, which established that maybe liability would shift, but that police certainly don't get to choose who is and isn't press. And that when there are these incidents, the press are allowed to be there. There was a big gray area, however, when it came to unlawful assembly, which police declare using Penal Code 409 and say, hey, everyone, get out of here or we're going to arrest you. Well, the press said that shouldn't apply to us. We're just here to document and observe. We're not participating in a riot. We are performing a vital act of public good. So after a similar series of incidents, I mentioned there were all these incidents here in LA, but in the last month, but in 2020 to 2021, we had 50 incidents statewide. And I sent a lot of that to the legislature after they had gone back and forth on some similar legislation before. And they opened their eyes, opened the governor's eyes, and they passed Senate Bill 98, which created 409.7. And this is simply a carve out, but very thoughtfully done. We negotiated things for weeks on end down to the placement of commas, which provides that when police declare that unlawful assembly, not only are press exempted, but police may not interfere with the press. And you know what? It's reciprocal. Press can't interfere with police, right? And so press can't commit any other crime. It's not carte blanche to steal a car or throw a brick. What it says is that if you're doing your job, essentially, you're allowed to remain and just don't interfere with the cops. They can't interfere with you. And if they do stop you, you can ask for a supervisor. And we even put in that provision. I want us to talk to your manager provision in state law. So that is the what we see violated by many of these officers. And I'd like to say that I, even though I'm not a lawyer, I think I have a pretty good sense of this law because, again, we place commas in this in certain ways to ensure that press, weren't allowed into a command post. And we get all these spurious arguments from law enforcement. Oh, well, this would be used to get into our command posts. no press wants to be in a command post when it's a mile away. And at the Echo Park incident in 2021 that many people may be familiar with, yes, the command post was a mile away from the incident in a Dodger Stadium parking lot. It wasn't at Echo Park. And so no more than, you know, press aren't allowed into the chief's office or a squad car to listen to the radio. And you know, you can't go in there. And so by the same token, this law did not create any magic special access in those kinds of circumstances. It simply said press can remain in what is normally a public area that has been closed due to the unlawful assembly. So that was one of the big wins. There is one other one that's worth noting, and that was Assembly Bill 48, which was focused on less lethal munitions. So I was not as involved in the placement of commas on that one, but I was very happy and very supportive, and my organization endorsed it and lobbied for it as well, because it's, among other things, creates a part of the penal code, and it's a five-digit one, so I can never memorize it. But it's one that says police must minimize the potential incidental impact of LLMs, the so-called less lethal munitions, on a whole bunch of categories, but explicitly journalists. And so those protections exist in the law. So when police are shooting journalists and others, when they are kettling them, when they are detaining or arresting them, they are acting unlawfully. And they are, in fact, breaking a law, which I helped write.
Oh, that's wonderful stuff. It reminds me, and I'm sure Maria, of the fact that the National Lawyers Guild here in Los Angeles and all over the country in the major cities provides legal observers. And we had to fight some years back for our right to have our legal observers remain, so as long as they weren't interfering with the arrest taking place after an illegal or so-called illegal assembly was taking place and an order to disperse had been issued. Because we too, very often the abuses by the police take place after, in fact, an assembly has been declared unlawful, rightly or wrongly, and people are in the process of being arrested, is often when police abuse is at its worst. So not to have our legals there was there would have been a great loss. Not to have the press there would be an equally great loss. And I'm so glad that you won that ability.
Well, thank you. It felt like a huge victory at the time, and we were thrilled with it. And we spent a lot of time working with local law enforcement agencies to ensure it was implemented correctly, that they had the language in their policies. We got memos from the leaders of LAPD, also addressing things like who is press. And we were very careful to ensure that we followed established precedent to cast a wide net. We want to protect freelancers, students, and independent journalists who maybe don't work for a large outlet but are posting to, you know, strictly to social media. I've always said that we're trying to protect the act of journalism. We're trying to protect the verb. We're not protecting the noun of journalist as a special class necessarily, even though they are called out in some of these laws. We really want to ensure that if you're not participating in the protest or an unlawful assembly, and you are there to document and you're committing no other crime, you should be able to remain. And as I've said to, you know, law enforcement, look, if you have 10,000 journalists standing around, maybe there's an interesting conversation, but there sure as heck is not a lot of action going on.
Right. That's right. Well, that's a very good point, because especially with the journalism isn't what it once was either. We have so many, many forms of journalism and forms of journalists that it's very important to separate the noun from that. You're quite right. Just one other comment before I turn it back to Maria again. People often get confused about the use of these so-called less lethal weapons. You've already pointed out that there are times when they are not less lethal at all. And even if they're not resulting necessarily in the death of someone, when they can cause a great deal of harm to the person physically. The weapons themselves are not to be shot directly at somebody. That is to say, you're not supposed to stand there with your gun pointed at their face or their chest or any part of their body. You're supposed to shoot these weapons off the ground a couple of feet ahead of them, allowing them to bounce up and sting. And I've been the recipient of those stinging bullets, but they're not going to cause you great bodily harm. They are going to get your attention. They are going to dissuade you probably from carrying on whatever activity the police don't want you to carry on. And then they're truly less lethal. Otherwise, it's questionable whether they're less lethal or not. I'm sorry.
Well, Jim, to your point, yes. It really depends how they're used. One of the these rounds, which was supposed to be fired over the heads, we believe this is with the LASD case involving Nick Stern. Our strong suspicion is the type of munition was a 40 millimeter, essentially what's like a flashbang. And there's all kinds of argument over the right terminology, but it's supposed to explode over the crowd and scare him. That was shot directly into his leg. It required hours of surgery. He was in the hospital for 4 days. A three-inch cap from it was removed from his leg. And so, and that is one of a handful of grotesque injuries. I won't horrify the audience any further. I think that one's grim enough. But, you know, these often when they're supposed to be skip fired is the term, bounced off the ground, they are not. The shrapnel from them can cause severe injuries. Occasionally, there are types which there's certain 40 millimeter foam rounds. Again, there's so many different varieties of these. They aim for the torso, but they've also hit someone in the eye. And so there is one young journalist who we don't know what the status will be. They were had 5 hours of eye surgery and may never see again, at least out of the one eye.
Dear me, dear me. It's quick to use them and often using them in very cowardly and inappropriate situations where they're not necessary at all. They just like to fire the damn things because they're wearing them or they're carrying them.
Mm-hmm. You're so right. And also a new dynamic we've noticed increasingly, I would say, even though it's been around for 25 years, is the horses. Which are charging and running people over, even press who are clearly, like, there's no longer anyone doing anything. They're just running over press to run the press away. Clearly, you know, people carrying multiple large cameras, press IDs around them, not interfering, off to the side, and they just charge them with a horse.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, speaking of all of those things, and I think, you know, listeners also saw some of those things happening on live television, you know, journalists being targeted. So what about the remedies here? So these are three lawsuits, I think three. So tell us, what are some of the remedies that you're all seeking? And I assume that, you know, let me ask this also. Has anyone, any of the officers been prosecuted individually or charged with any crime yet that you know of? But then separately, let us know what Los Angeles Press Club and the other plaintiffs are seeking as a result of the lawsuits.
So let me tackle the second question first, which is about the individual officers. I am unaware, going back years, I mean, back 25 years, of any officer facing serious discipline, even going back to like the May Day melee when the city, and this all comes out of your in my pocket, right? We're, as the taxpayers, we pay for the settlements. Yes. The officers have qualified immunity. And so even when they... In the 2007 May Day melee, when they had like a 3-day suspension, I think the union even got that overturned, despite tens of millions of dollars being paid out by us, the taxpayer. So in the last 5 years, I've probably filed several dozen complaints specifically about LAPD officers. I don't know of a single act of discipline. Obviously, these are personnel files, so they won't release a lot, but they're very cagey and secretive about it. And frankly, that sends a message to other officers that they can get away with it. In terms of the remedies that we seek, you know, again, I'm not a lawyer and I defer to our lawyers to, in terms of how TROs may work and other injunctive relief. However, I will hit on points that I've been making for years. One is that we need clear instruction from the top and clear messaging. Set the tone from the chief, from the mayor, from the city council, and say, we need to protect and serve the press. That is the job of LAPD, among other very important responsibilities that police have. But they aren't fulfilling their job if they're not keeping press rights intact. So send that message loud and clear. Say that the misconduct, the violence towards press is unacceptable. Something as simple as that is not a legal remedy per se. It's just the basics. Then I think that we have issues around the accountability and the discipline. Then I think we have issues around the training. And this is not something I'm the only one talking about. The LA Police Department Training Bureau has been asking for decades for more crowd control training. Command staff just cuts it instead. And so I also love to remind people that, you know, think about the number of hours required in training or on the job to become certified for certain professions. In this state, California, a police officer needs 664. Now, LAPD goes significantly beyond that to 912 hours before you can graduate from the academy. My barber needs 1,000 hours. Acupuncturist needs 3,000. Repossession manager needs 6,000. Yeah. So, you know, I think combined, we're seeing a lack of preparedness on the behalf of these officers. That is a failure of command staff. You know, those are among the types of things that I hope to see addressed. And then there's also really simple things. pocket cards that they can refer to. So when someone says, hey, I'm pressed, they can pull it out of their pocket, the officer, and say, oh yeah, I need to contact my supervisor. I just need to let him pass. And if I've always said, look, if we can de-escalate that way and they can say, hey, can you check your pocket card, the press know to say that, that would mentally de-escalate with the officer and go, oh yeah, my job is to look at that. You know, I always remind press to talk in penal code, but little things like that. And we'll see what actually comes out of the injunctions. I've got a million ideas, but ultimately what comes out in court will be dependent on what our wonderful attorneys who are doing an amazing pro bono job here, where we salute them and thank them. Carol Sobel, who many people may know, Peter Bibbring, Peter Eliasberg, Weston Rowland, you know, David Loy, the BHB team. I could go on, but
And we're talking about National Lawyers Guild and ACLU lawyers, and we're very proud of them both.
Amen.
You're quite right for that. Well, Adam, it's been a joy to have you with us. It really has. I've learned a lot. I suspect our listeners have. Where can they learn more about the LA Press Club and its lawsuits?
You're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome to follow our organization. We're lapressclub.org. And then on social media, most platforms were LA Press Club. You can find me personally, where I've been posting pretty actively about this on Blue Sky in particular. My handle there is just my name, Adam Rose. And then on other platforms, I'm at Joro, A-D-J-O-R-O. But mostly I'm on Blue Sky these days for reasons I think people could speculate on.
But we have time for one more question, so I'm going to get it in really quickly. So I have one of my favorite questions is something I'm thinking about every day now, because lawyers are in the, lawyers are getting retaliated against. Anyone basically telling the truth, telling the story of people who this administration doesn't like, can be the subject of retaliation and intimidation. So you all as journalists, yes, you may sometimes have targets on your backs. So how do you stay strong? How did, obviously, LA Press Club didn't hesitate to be the front and center plaintiff on these lawsuits. Tell us, help us all get some courage and what keeps you going?
We're not alone. This is the great experiment in democracy, and we're in this together. So I will say, my numbers that I've been throwing out here are a significant undercount. Lawyers are listening, so you all know that if you're a corporate counsel, you're probably telling your employees who have been injured or detained, don't talk about this in public. I am sure that there's a lot more incidents that I don't even know about. And sure, for certain individuals and certain legal situations, I fully respect that. So know that the community can step up together and that united, we are stronger. We're not alone even as one organization. We've got obviously co-plaintiffs, but we're also backed by an enormously successful historically and marvelous coalition of press rights organizations. Too many to list. We're talking dozens of them. And I am so grateful for all of them. So I am heartened by that. Personally, I come from a family of journalists, I carry that with me every day I go into this fight, thinking of my mom, my dad, and my brother.
Well, you're a wonderful press spokesperson for the press and for those rights. And we thank you so much for being with us on the Lawyers Guild show today. We'll have you back from time to time to see how these lawsuits are going, by the way.
It'd be an honor.
It'll be fun to watch them going through the courts, and then we'll know specifically what kind of relief we can expect and what kind of new behavior we can hold the LAPD accountable to, which is very important. But for now, I think that's all the time we have here on the Lawyers Guild show as well, although I haven't heard our music yet. Sometimes,
what about a dispersal order?
I think it's time the three of us need to disperse, although sometimes the engineer will give us a sign. We do this now in a way where we can't just see our engineer. We can't see our board op. So we sometimes have to just kind of look at the clock and say, well, I think we're probably at a point where we should say goodbye. And then we know that when they start playing our music, our goodbye music, which is the same as our hello music. So it's kind of like no time to say hello, goodbye. But we will have you back, Adam, and we'll... Do we know, as a matter of fact... when the first rulings on some of the injunctive relief that's requested is likely to come down?
So we did not get the temporary restraining order initially on the federal case. That was within 48 hours, but all three of these cases are still active. I don't have an exact timeline. So sooner the better, though, because these protests aren't slowing down.
All right.
Yep. Excellent.
Until next week at the same time, we thank everyone for listening today. The Lawyers Guild Show will be right back with you again next Wednesday at the same time, friends. Until then, on behalf of Brielle and myself, we thank you so much for listening today. And we urge you to stay healthy. And just as important, we urge you to stay active and stand up for your rights.
Don't give up the fight. Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah. Get up, stand up.
Jab, jab.
Stand up for your rights.
I'm Andrew Tonkovich of KPFK's weekly literary arts show, Bibliocracy. Support this program and the station by hitting the online donations button at kpfk.org. Choose the monthly donation option and, like me, become a sustaining member all year round. Thank you.